Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to Treasures from Malta, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an art historian and an artist with a long connection with Patrimonio. I'll be presenting this podcast and meeting some of Malta's living treasures. These treasures are artists, historians or art collectors with some Malta connection. They're all fair game for the pod and we want to share them with you. There are two sides to you, culture and the law. In culture, you have left an indelible mark in researching, discovering and publishing your countless finds. You have given us new angles on the history of art in Malta, as well as writing about myriad aspects of Maltese history. You have also written about the law, both critiques of contemporary judgments, as well as delving into aspects of legal and constitutional history. As a human rights lawyer in the 80s, you were at the forefront of change, at difficult times where it took pluck to stand up and speak truth to power. You later took up a position as judge at the European Court of Human Rights, where your judgments, and particularly your separate opinions, were not just competent, but groundbreaking. In sum, you have looked back and uncovered history, but you have also made history. Giovanni Bonello, welcome to the podcast.
Hello, Francesca, and thank you very much for this introduction. I think we're starting on the wrong foot. I've already told you that any interview by the end of which people are still on speaking terms is not a good interview. And I believe you started on the wrong foot.
This will characterize the rest of the podcast, whatever. I believe. Yeah, we'll talk about that later. You were brought up in a cultured family. Your father, Vincenzo Bonello, was a pioneer in Malta of professional art history, art criticism and scientific art conservation practices. He set up the National Museum of Fine Arts and acquired for it most of its major masterpieces. He also founded the School of Arts. He had a major say in the founding of two other leading museums in Malta, the St. John's Co-Cathedral Museum and the Indina Cathedral Museum. He worked as an architect, for example, the Calcara Parish Church and the Home for the Clergy in Birkirkara are actually built to his plans. He also designed the decorative work in several churches, like the Tapino Basilica in Gozo and the Meliha Sanctuary. He was the first curator to be appointed for the newly established Fine Arts section in the museum's department, before being unfairly divested of this position, followed by internment in Malta and deportation to Uganda, again unfairly and in full breach of the law, by the colonial powers in wartime Malta. You were then a mere child, a four-year-old. You next saw your father at age 9. How strong was your father's influence on your subsequent life choices, the law and the unrelenting pursuit of history?
Well, my father was basically a person who only lived to improve his mind, to live for culture. He had no money sense at all, and I think he passed that to my DNA too. But I think that the idea that I became a human rights lawyer because of my father's injustices is not quite correct. I became a human rights lawyer basically for other reasons, which are also connected with my father. My father was in art and he was very creative. I chose law, law was chosen for me, and the idea of doing law, which hasn't changed since 1,000 years, always repeating the same mantras of the law, didn't appeal to me. Thankfully, by the time I started practicing, human rights law had become the in thing. And in Malta, we're totally divested of any human rights culture. I found that to be my niche, and I decided to that it was something that appealed to me, that I could do properly, because human rights law at this early stage was totally creative. You had to invent every next step. There were no textbooks, there were no written judgments, no case law, no precedents, nothing at all. You start on your own, and you have to build up your culture by being creative.
Were there particular incidents of injustice that really got you to realize that there was such a gap in the law, and that needed to be made there and then through judgments?
One of the reasons is that as human rights law was not understood yet, human rights in the sense that there is one law which is superior to all other laws. Every other law that is not compatible with human rights is a bad law. And this is the concept that human rights law started. So yes, I mean, to your question, justice is not infallible. Justice is human. And most of the times, hopefully, it serves its functions. But there are repeatedly cases of injustice, repeatedly. So the sense that you go to seek justice and you come out with injustice instead of justice made me rebel, made me feel that I had to do something about it.
Mm-hmm. What do you recall of the war?
The war. The war started on my fourth birthday, exactly, 11 June, the war with Italy. And I do remember quite a few things. I remember my birthday, if I can say something which still touches me quite a lot. I was in my mother's arms in Rabat, and at night suddenly it was all bombs, explosions, flares, searchlights. And of course I started crying. And my mother told me, "What are you worried about? These are fireworks for your birthday." And that was one of the very first things I remember about my mother's goodness. Then the war was terrible. I mean, even the wealthy people suffered badly in the war because food was extremely scarce. I remember stealing carrots from horses to eat in the street. I remember that we lived on charity. My father was exiled. We had zero income. It was our uncles that saw us through. But we literally lived on charity. We remember when we got used to the war, going out of the shelters to watch the dogfights between the Italian and German pilots and the RAF on the other side. We were very excited by that. Sometimes the Germans took us, would be below our eye level, and we could make eye contact with the pilots. It was so close. So yes, I remember the war as an experience I would not wish to anyone else.
What about the destruction on the buildings and even dead bodies? And all that?
Yes, I mean, that is well known. I mean, if anybody has seen photos of the war, there are usually masses of rubble, masses of masonry strewn all over the streets, all over everywhere. Because Malta was historically the most bombarded place in the world. So that is another memory, but that is shared by many other people.
Yes. You had an unusual education, at least in the early years, and we share an alma mater, which is the St. Doherty's Convent School for Girls. Tell me about it.
Well, my two elder sisters, were at St. Doherty's. And when the nuns came to know that I was of school age and that my mother couldn't afford to pay the fees, they just offered very kindly to take me in without fees. And I found myself the only boy in a girls' school, 200 girls probably, and I was the only little boy there feeling a bit out of the water and feeling too young to enjoy the fact that I was surrounded by 200 pretty girls.
You must have been the class pet, though.
In a way, yes. I mean, at that stage, I don't remember any acts of cruelty. The nuns were extremely good and kind. And from my schools, my classmates, who were all girls, I don't remember anything particularly untoward.
Well, it appears to have been a good foundation in your education, because you didn't do too badly, I would say. Let's talk about research. Now here, your interests are incredibly broad, from clocks in Malta to the first treatise on chocolate, from pestles to postcards, from prayer to political history, and many, many other subjects in between. Now, what drives you to research a subject, and how do you select what to research?
What drives me to research a subject? Well, it's my natural inquisitiveness. I don't direct it to racehorses or to cars. My natural inquisitiveness is something which I probably inherited from my father, never knowing enough. There's always something else to be discovered. And that has been the driving force. Most of my discoveries were not things I searched for. They were the Sod's Law, that you're looking for something and you don't find it. But looking for something, you come across something else. And that ignites, sparks a new interest in you. And then you follow that trail.
And what is your research process? I mean, how do you, and also, how do you organize your research to avoid losing stuff in your own archives? Because we all know that you have, you know, years worth of research notes.
Yes, I have a lot of notes. One thing about me, which I have to confess, is that, like my father, I very rarely throw away a written paper. The other side of that is that I very rarely find anything I'm looking for. So that's another thing to keep in mind. I'm not very organized. I have this compulsion to do things, but I do them a lot on the spur of the moment. And the fact, I started researching when I was a lawyer in Malta. And I remember whenever I had a break between one case and another, an hour break, I would rush off to the biblioteca and ask for a volume of manuscripts and go through it and take notes, which I normally lost afterwards. But the system was that.
Mm-hmm. So you organize it with a card catalog system?
I mean, I don't have a card catalog.
Pre-computer days, obviously.
This is pre-computer days. Computer has helped enormously. Mm-hmm. Because if I write something in computer, it's there.
Yeah.
It will take me hours to look for it because I don't remember the under what file name I put it, but it's there and it's going to turn up one moment or other.
Nonetheless, you managed to put research together from different sources, so clearly you are able to find your old research and use it.
Some of it, yes.
New subjects. But with research is part luck and part astuteness on the part of the researcher. And you've had many lucky finds. Anyone in particular stands out when you look back?
Well, I mean, I've published 35 books, either completely written by me or partly written by me as general editor. And if I look back, yes, there are many highlights of things I remember. And I don't think it would be fair to pick up on this. They're all my little children, and I don't think it's fair. But there are some discoveries which stand out. For example, from the gossipy side of things, I remember my big surprise to find that Grand Master de Valette, the savior of Christianity in Europe, had at least three legitimate children. That was something which was a shock and a revelation. So I worked on these three children and discovered that this is beyond doubt. I found actually the legitimation process of one of his children, one of his male children, in a library in France. The manuscript where the son of the Valette pleads with the French king to consider him legitimate. He doesn't say why, but I think the reason why is because he wanted to become a priest. And at that time, children born out of wedlock were not allowed to become priests. And this chap says, I'm the legitimate son of Grand Master de Valette of Malta, and will you see your way to legitimize me? And the king said, well done.
When you look back, can you pinpoint what perhaps was the most important discovery that you made in the archives?
Well, it is more than historical, it's artistic. I was going through a project of finding out the manuscripts of unpublished histories of the Order of Malta. There are a number of unpublished histories. And one of the totally forgotten unpublished histories of the Order of Malta, which is still in manuscript, was at the public library. And I asked to see it, and this manuscript was brought out for me. And going through it, I saw that there were two drawings, which I wasn't expecting. I was looking for the text. There were these two drawings, which I overlooked. And then suddenly something sparked in me. I said, oh, those drawings are Mattia Preti's. And they are extraordinary Mattia Preti's. They're the only drawings by Mattia Preti's which were meant to be turned into engravings. They were to be illustrations of this manuscript book. And this was quite a discovery because Mattia Preti is known as a very good draftsman and his drawings are quite well studied. But these are the only drawings by Mattia Preti which were preparatory to being engraved. And finding these, two of them, staring at me. Again, I wasn't looking for them. I was looking for the text. And in fact, I almost overlooked them, except that something in my brain went in reverse and said, oh, what were those two drawings they're doing when I was flipping to the manuscript?
Not so much the brain, but the trained eye as well. Is that an important consideration for you?
I remember I wouldn't trust my eyes, so I went up to Maroma Camilleri, who's always very helpful. I said,
at the biblioteca.
At the National Library. And I told her, look at this manuscript, put it under lock and key, because I want to have a second opinion. And I remember the next day, I asked Teresa Vella, to come with me. I didn't tell her why. I said, come and have a look at these drawings. What do you think? Oh, those are Mattia Preti's. And it confirmed what I said. And now today they're accepted in the opus of Mattia Preti.
That's wonderful.
They're extraordinary.
And the truth is, art historians wouldn't have known to look for Preti's there.
No idea. I mean, why should find
why should they,
in an old manuscript, half of it illegible because through age, that you should find these two splendid masterpieces by Mattia Preti.
Serendipity. Do you find that these sort of finds fuel your research? I mean, sometimes you spend hours and you find nothing.
Yeah.
Like you mentioned before, you set out to look for something and you just don't find it.
But that is the rule, that you don't find what
exactly.
You're looking for.
But the incidental finds are such fun.
Then when at a tangent, something points in another direction, that is, as you're saying, call it fun.
What are you presently working on in terms of research?
My immediate are two projects. Recently, four books about Luigi Maria Ugolini, a 1930s archaeologist who was badly treated by time, by history, and by his fellow archaeologists, were published by Mizzi Books. And these are four. Ugolini died when he was 40. So he only published one book about Walter, but he had another three ready for publication, which were never published. And they got lost in an Italian archive. And recently, Professor Vella, Nicholas Vella, and Dr. Pessina rediscovered this archive and have been working 20 years to bring this archive to life. And I have been asked to review this book. I'm working on the review. One. Two, I'm working also on a project I'm not quite sure will materialize, because the Maltese connection is there, but I don't know whether it's of great interest to Maltese people. In the 1950s, the British Secret Service from Malta directed a big operation in Albania. They got Albanians to Malta, trained them in spying, and send them back to Albania. It's a tragic story. They all got caught and almost all were shot as spies. They lived in Malta before going there. One of the trainers in Malta was the parents of Chris de Burgh, and it's remained a mystery how these spies were all caught without a single exception. All of them went there to die, to be executed. And
there might have been a mole.
And the mole is the famous Philby. Philby knew all about this, and everybody trusted Philby, and he was passing information to the communist regimes at that time. And he was responsible for the death of these 30, 40 Albanians.
How long were they in Malta for?
They were in Malta for 3, 4, 5 months. They were getting training in guerrilla warfare, in wireless communications, in political, because the idea was to send them there to urge the people to rise against the communist regime. So I have a lot of material on this very unknown subject.
Is it well documented? Look abroad.
Now it's being well documented. I didn't find anything in Malta, but in foreign archives and foreign publications, quite a lot has been published on this.
That was my next question, actually. You speak about biblioteca, and it is a bottomless source for us, for researchers. But you have worked in foreign archives as well. Is it something that you pursue, or if you happen to be living in a place like you were living in Strasbourg, the archives that are available there?
It's more of a second. I've never traveled exactly to examine an archive. But when I was in France, for example, I did tap all the archives which were within my distance. And that's where I discovered, for example, the petition of the Valets, Lovechild, to become legitimate. That was discovered when I was in Strasbourg in a French archive.
Mm-hmm. Again, a lucky find, because...
A lucky up to a certain point, because I knew that this archive had a book of legitimations indexed. And that when I went to the index, I found the Valet, son of, and a number of other Knights of Malta who had children and asked to be legitimate, French Knights of Malta. The most important one was, of course, Grand Master de Valet. But besides him, there were quite a number of other French leading knights who had children and asked to be legitimated. So this volume, which was, as far as I know, unknown in Malta, helped me to build up a picture of the secret lives of many prominent Knights of Malta.
Talking about the Valets, a few years ago you stirred up a real hornet's nest when you insisted that the proper way of addressing, or the proper way of describing and calling Grandmaster de Valet was de Valet, not La Valette, as we have always referred to him. What happened with that? Because the controversy raged on in the newspapers.
It did rage, but today
historians took sides, and it became a great...
Francesca, today I would say that all serious historians have stopped calling him La Valette, because I demonstrated, I think, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the name La Valette was never used in his lifetime. La Valette was the city. And over time, people started conflating the name of the Grand Master with the name of the city. And as everybody knew about La Valette, the city, I think there was a transfer from the city's name to the Grand Master. But during his lifetime, all the documents, all the medals, all the coins, all the signatures, it's always the Valette. Valette or the Valette.
I believe even the family at the time weighed in. Yes. The descendants had weighed in on this whole matter as well.
Yes, the descendants said, no, we've always been La Valette. Mm-hmm. I'm not in any way disclaiming your right to use the name you would like to be called, but your ancestor, your collateral ancestor, was certainly de Valet. And today I don't know of one serious historian who still refers to him as La Valet.
This seems like a good place to take a break.
This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, jurist and author Judge Giovanni Bonello.
We're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode. Now, let's talk about books. As you mentioned before, there are 35 books under your belt at this stage. You've written a number of them and edited some of the rest. Now, what was your first book, and how on earth do you find the time and the energy when most of us are shattered after our first or second book?
Well, my first published books was a sort of study and catalogue of the early postcards of Malta. And there's a story to it. This was in 1987. I had been commissioned by Mid-Med Bank, which published a book every year to give to their clients and to give to personalities. And on that year, they knew of my interest in old postcards, and they had commissioned me to write a book about postcards. And I wrote a book, and it was printed, and suddenly I get a phone call from Midmet Bank. The police have impounded your book. Impounded my book. What is it? They said, because there's a law that you can't use the word Maltese in the title. And I had used Maltese postcard 1898, 1906. And the book was impounded. And what do we do? What do we do? Thankfully, it was the chairman of Midmet Bank saw how ridiculous this was. And he was a person who was quite in with the authorities, and he managed to get an amnesty for the book. And the book was eventually published. But the first reaction was that the book was something against national security. Just imagine a book about postcards 100 years old.
Very threatening. Do you work on more than one book at the same time, or are you entirely focused on one book at a go?
Francesca, I describe myself as a short sprinter. I'm not a marathon runner. I can only write up to 10,000 words. After that, I'm bored and I want to change the subject. So all my writings are shortish. And most of my books are collections of my previous writings. I re-edit them, I rewrite them, I polish them a bit, but they're basically my short features published in some magazine or newspaper and then put together. That is generally how it works. So you don't require stamina to write 10,000 words. If I was writing 150,000 words, yes, that would require stamina, which I don't have. I am not a marathon runner.
You've also been the focus of books. Much has been written about you, and you've received more Festschrift than anyone I know. Two have already been published, the most recent being the Merlin and FBM collaboration on your 80th birthday, which featured short stories by leading authors who took inspiration from the historic figures that you had researched and discovered. And it was really a homage to your history writing and a compliment in literature. And I know another publication is in the pipeline, which will be dedicated to you. Let me add to this a very personal tribute and a personal assessment of you. I first contacted you way back in the early 2000s, so that's two decades ago, and I had just started my research in history of art. So for me it was extremely daunting. You were already a giant on the art historical and legal field, and at the time you were actually one of the most exalted judges in the European Court. And yet, within an hour, I had received your reply by email. And not only was it a long email, but you even very generously shared some unpublished research, which you told me, feel free to use yourself. I don't need to publish it myself, go ahead. Which is extremely generous from the point of view of a historian. And since then, we've struck up a friendship, I'd say, which is very much based on you teasing me mercilessly. And I think I occasionally respond in kind, perhaps more often than occasionally. But even your one-liners are hilarious. And yet, you're incredibly shy and very, very private. I had to bully you to guest on this podcast. Do you hide behind your writing?
Well, my writing is my public face. As you said, by nature, I am not pushy, I am not at all attention-seeking, at least I hope. But my writing is my way of communicating with people. I believe that it is a sort of duty to share with others. I mean, this is something I learned from my father. My father was much more knowledgeable than I am. His culture far exceeded mine. But he published very little. Today, his published works are, compared to mine, are minuscule. They're really very, very minor. He knew much more than that, but he was a perfectionist, and he'd always, I remember saying, why don't you publish that? No, because I want to study it more, because I have to research a little bit further. I want to polish that. And he ended up by doing very little, by publishing very little.
He deprived society of all his knowledge, in a way.
That taught me not to be like my father in this. That the moment I have something, as usual, very shortish, on the shortest side, I write it, I check it, and I send it for publication. Yes, I am very, very private, and this is one of my few channels of communication, of connecting with other people. I feel it's my duty. Since I have it, I don't have to take it with me to Dia Dolorata. I want to leave it behind me as my inheritance. I'm not leaving a lot of money behind me. I'm just leaving my books and my research.
In fact, it's one of the things I remember you mentioning to me and encouraging me to publish. You used to give me that example, and I'm sure you've done it with many, many other researchers. You used to mention your father and say, what a pity that all his knowledge was really not published at all. So you died with him in a way. Did he leave notes, though, that you can now look back upon and publish?
He left very skeletal notes, which are not very useful for further research. Because in a way, he was like me. He didn't use a computer, but he used to have little pads of paper next to him and write a name, an adjective or something, and a reference page number. So there's two skeletal to be used.
And yet you have used some of his archive. For example, the letters that Robert Caruana Dingley, the celebrated artist, had written to him because they were very, very good friends. And in fact, that knowledge, you were able to research these letters and you published them in a very beautiful book that was published some years ago by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti.
Yeah, my father was a prototype of what I am. He never threw away a letter, a telegram or a postcard from abroad. And he had some very important correspondents like Berenson, like Longhi. They were literally on frequent correspondence terms. And he kept all the letters. And you mentioned Robert Caruana Dingley, because I got Robert Caruana Dingley because they're of very topical interest, particularly Gothic interest. But I have all the letters of Shortino, of Hannibal Scicluna. I have all the letters of Fabriani. I have all the letters of Ugolini.
Will they see the light of day?
The Shortino ones, I've published them. The Ugolini ones, I gave them to Nicolas Vella, which he published too. And there are very, very others. There are many, many others.
Are you still going to? Do you know the extent of your father's archive? Have you gone through absolutely everything?
No, it's impossible, because there are towers of Pisa everywhere of letters which are going to go one way or the other.
My goodness, what a treasure trove.
Whatever. I mean, the future archives will have.
So they will be accessible, you think, to the public in future?
Some of them are extremely interesting. Because, for example, when my father was buying works of art for the museum, he used to take advice from Berenson, from the various big art historians and critics from Italy mostly. Not only from Italy, but mostly from Italy. And there are all his correspondents by that Vincenzo. There is this beautiful Valentine on sale by, because it's going to be really.
This might be off limit, so I can cut it out completely, but are you considering how this can be accessed by the public in future?
Well, these letters belong to me and the heirs of my sister, but probably they'll end up in some archive of some museum, either the National Archives or the Winniacorta Archives. I've already given all the drawings by my father to the Winniacorta, 1,200 drawings. Yeah. Architectural drawings by my father. Me and my sister decided to leave them, to bequeath them to the Winniacourt Museum.
Left works of art to the nation, the recent donation of the Palladini painting to Musa. Mm-hmm. So, you know, this is an act of extreme generosity and one that should be emulated.
That's what I have in mind. That's what I have in mind. I mean, these papers can be pulped. As usually, unfortunately, happens in Malta, when somebody dies, all the papers are thrown away. I don't intend to do that.
No, not at this stage. They would not be pulped because I think our appreciation of history has grown exponentially, and there are far more historians and art historians who appreciate the value of archives.
Agreed.
I keep saying that your history writing, though entirely based on fact and very properly referenced, flows so beautifully, and it's written in such style and with wit that truly it falls almost within the realm of literature. You also write poetry, which is a bit of an insight into your inner soul. Will you treat us to your autobiography one day?
Number one, about poetry. Poetry, I do write, but it's me talking to myself. Do you want to be overheard when you're talking to yourself?
So that is something. You've published bits of it.
But very big, 4 lines a year, never more than 4 lines in a year. Whatever it's worth. But I consider that my private conversation with myself. Probably it's easy because I'm probably schizophrenic, so one can talk to the other. And I don't want anybody to overhear me. So that's my poetry. The other question was?
Wait a bit. No, you don't get off so lightly.
Oh, okay.
You write it, so there is some externalizing of your internal feelings.
Uh-huh.
What do you intend to do?
Destroy.
You will destroy them.
Yeah, yeah. Those are my own, as I told you, I mean, when I talk aloud to myself, I don't want anybody to overhear me.
So why do you write it?
Because it's one way of letting off steam, emotional steam, yes. Intellectual steam.
But maybe clarifying your thoughts as well.
Yes, of course, sometimes. But when I write poetry, I write mostly about feeling, not about rationality. I mean, rationality doesn't come very much into the poetry that I would write.
What about an autobiography?
Never, no. I mean, autobiographies, I respect people who write their autobiographies. But an autobiography is a statement. Look how important I am. I think that posterity needs to know about me. And that is certainly not me. I mean, if I go totally gaga, maybe I will write my autobiography and it will be fun. But at this stage, I'm too reserved, private, secretive a person to want to share my successes and my failures with everybody else. Usually autobiographies are about your successes. Your failures are usually in footnotes.
Yeah, but on the other hand, it's also a story, a very human story of the evolution of your career. And it's a very interesting and varied career, as we've seen. So will you deprive us of it?
Yes, I have many faults, but I'm not an exhibitionist.
Okay. There might be other ways of convincing you. Let's talk about the law. Your separate opinions in the European Court of Human Rights became the stuff of legend, and you became known as the Great Dissenter. For example, this is what leading human rights observers said about your very last opinion. And here I have to clarify that I pick only a very few comments from literally a sea of approving ones. So Ray Corrigan from the United Kingdom said this about you. Judge Giovanni Bonello's officially concurring but substantially dissenting opinion in the European Court of Human Rights should be read by everyone. It is relatively short, very accessible, and one of the most scathing and explosive critiques by a judge of the UK government in particular, but also of the European Court of Human Rights that I've ever read. And another commentator, Bonello is extremely sharp, rational, witty, and literature talented. He wrote a rhetorical gem. Unfortunately, Giovanni Bonello is now retired, and his loss seems like the destruction of an invaluable work of art. The Maltese Falcon is gone. Tell us about taking up this role of judge in the European Court, where you knew you would be faced with incredibly important cases against states, and they would be landmark by their very nature. Did you feel like a small fish in a very big pond? And what was that experience like?
Francesca, before going to Strasbourg, I had been through 170 human rights cases. mostly of victims against abuse of power. So I had the proper training. I said I'm not an exhibitionist, and I hope we won't end this interview by me, but I think 170 human rights cases must be a world record. I mean, all the human rights lawyers I met, and their record was 20, 22, 30, 100, I did 170.
That's remarkable.
So I was pretty well prepared. When I went to Strasbourg and I met the giants of human rights law of Europe, my colleagues were, at first I was a bit daunted, and I kept my silence. I listened a lot, and you know, over a short period I realized that these giants had two arms like me, two ears like me too. And that's when I acquired the self-confidence that I needed. And then I became maybe over-self-confident because I didn't pull my punches anymore. If I had to say something, I would try to say it in the most damaging and impressive way possible. That's why I got the reputation of being the center and the person who wrote in a way that is worth reading.
There is another aspect to you that few people know of. Your exercises in abstract photography. Tell me about them.
Well, that's another very private thing. Very few people knew about them. I enjoy distorting reality, keeping reality, but distorting it. I showed my photos to very, very few people. Recently, my good friend Daniel Cilia, who is one of the leading photographers of Malta, if not the very leading one, came to know about them and offered to write to collect my abstract photos and publish them and comment on them. I think that's a great honor to have Daniel Cilia comment on the work of an amateur, because actually my photography is... my driving principle is breaking all the rules of photography. I mean, photography tells you have to focus. I don't focus. You don't have to move your camera. I move my camera. You don't have to underexpose. I underexpose or overexpose. So by breaking all the rules of photography, I get the results which will soon be published.
A bit
somewhere.
Of a rebel.
Yeah.
But how long have you been taking photographs? Are we looking back at a decades-long career?
I've been taking snapshots forever and ever. Mm-hmm. I remember I used my first camera was my father's Voigtland in the 1920s. And he lent it to me, and I used it with roll film. And then I bought my own cameras, and I've been taking snapshots all the time. But my abstract streak, I call it non-figurative, not abstract. My non-figurative mode started in the 1980s, I would say, or 1990s.
And you're still at it now?
Yes, occasionally I have this idea of going back to it. The problem is that I lost all my early ones. I put them somewhere and I don't know where they are. The ones which were printed from negatives, I don't know where they are.
In fact, are you using analog still?
No, now I'm using digital.
Digital.
But you can do that.
And you
can
print? Are you printing? No?
No, I don't print. No. I just, the image, I put it on computer and it's there. And the ones that Daniel Cilia chose, he chose 12, I believe, are taken from my computer.
Amongst other art objects, you collect African art. What sparked this interest? And do you focus on a specific region in Africa? What kind of art do you collect?
Well, I collect African art. I think there are two main reasons why my passion for African art started. Number one, because when my father came back from Africa in 1945, he bought a few objects of indigenous art with him here. And I was fascinated by them. These are, again, art which breaks most of the canons of traditional European art. And that was one of the reasons why I was fascinated by African art. I think the second reason is that, I'll say something probably scandalous, that I consider Picasso the greatest artist of all times. For me, Picasso is the one who managed to renew himself every 10 years. There was a new Picasso. Every time, probably an improvement on the one before. And Picasso was very much attracted by African art and influenced by African art. And these two reasons, I think, were the ones that triggered my passion for African art. Unfortunately, in Malta, it's very difficult to obtain new specimens. The last two nice bits I obtained was from Don Mintoff's auction. There were two lovely pieces of African art. Probably they were presents to him by Mugabe or by one of the African tyrants, probably. And they were for sale, and they went for a very accessible price. There was the only one who bid for them. And those are my two latest accretions to my collection.
Do you specifically focus on sculpture or other forms of art?
Well, most African art is sculpture. It's mostly sculpture. Bronze, ebony, wood, clay, but it's mostly sculpture, plastic. Plastic, and it's a plastic art.
What's your collecting focus? You look at objects of rite, ritual objects, or...
Well, most...
Are you not guided by any particular principles?
Most African art is a ritual. There is some utilitarian art.
Or decorative, perhaps.
But there is... Most of it is ritual. It's connected with something, some dimension of the spirit. It's either to push away evil spirits,
yes,
or to attract the good spirits, or to get protection from them.
Protection or invocation.
Yeah, most of it is that way.
Do you focus, for example, on mosques rather than objects of cult?
The market is so small that anything which I can afford, whether it's a mosque, or whether it's a statuette, or whether it's a plaque, or whether it's an ornament, a body ornament, or a bracelet, I will try to get. Within my financial.
And do you focus on a specific area of Africa? Because African art is incredibly diverse, obviously.
Exactly. I mean, I started off with my father's, which is East Africa, which is not one of the major regions. The best region is Nigeria and the side. Those, there are some wonderful masterpieces. The very old ones are now museum pieces. They are totally unfindable. You only find
the Benin bronze.
The Benin bronze, yes, yes. I have one piece which I was told is a Benin bronze. It's a small plaque which most of the palace of Benin were covered with these bronze plaques, and I have one of them which hopefully is not a fake. But the great art is West African art. All of it is interesting, but the apex of creativity and of the spirit of African plastic art is from West Africa.
And the final question. With such a capture on history and art, and with a lifetime's experience in helping to shape the law, what are your aspirations for Malta's future?
My aspirations for Malta's future is to be proud again of being Maltese.
Giovanni Bonello, thank you so much for agreeing, although it was very hard to get you to agree, to be a guest on this podcast. Thank you for sharing a bit of a glimpse into your life, your art, and your appreciation of art, your discovery of history, and all you've contributed towards the good name of Malta.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website under the podcast section. That's www.patrimonio.org.